I'm calling to order the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. And has everyone seen the minutes? Representative Freiberg? Any questions on the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes pass. Okay, first on the agenda. Okay, would be House File 2792. The chair moves House File 2792 before the committee. And the author can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to hear House File 2792. It's a bill that's the consequence of an avoidable mistake. Last biennium, the legislature targeted certain political speech and attempted to ban certain speech and under the category of foreign-influenced speech, and that bill, as many members, including myself, warned, was challenged in court, was held to be unconstitutional in the District Court of Minnesota, and the consequence of that, as was discussed in the last legislative session, was that attorney's fees have been awarded to the challenger, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And that is exactly what has happened in the District Court in Minnesota. And so the bill on that, on those attorney's fees is about to come due. It appears that it will approach $900,000, and so this bill is necessary to account for that financial obligation that the state of Minnesota is going to incur. I do have here today to testify about the bill, Brian Cook from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
And please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Chair Quam, members of the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. My name is Brian Cook. I'm the Director of Taxes, Fiscal Policy, and Elections for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Appreciate the opportunity to share some additional background on House File 2792. On May 5th, 2023, Governor Walz signed House File 3 into law. The bill contained provisions that amended Minnesota Statutes 211B.15 to bar so-called foreign-influenced corporations from exercising their constitutional rights to participate in political speech. This proposal raised serious constitutional questions throughout the legislative process. As a result of the law's enactment and on behalf of our members' rights, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce filed a lawsuit in federal court challenging the constitutionality of that law on June 30th, 2023. The defense in that suit were John Choi in his capacity as the Ramsey County Attorney and the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. On December 20th, 2023, Judge Tostrud granted us a preliminary injunction preventing the law from taking effect as scheduled on January 1st, 2024. Then, on February 7th, 2025, Judge Tostrud ruled in favor of our motion on summary judgment, permanently blocking enforcement of the law. His order highlighted the statute's constitutional flaws, finding it not narrowly tailored and both over-inclusive and under-inclusive in its application. The statute was over-inclusive in how expansively the definition stretched and under-inclusive since it excluded labor unions, partnerships, nonprofits, or cooperatives. The deadline for the defendants to appeal passed earlier this month. Because the chamber prevailed in this federal civil rights case, we are entitled to recover attorney's fees and costs from those defendants. We are seeking $754,234.15 plus additional costs incurred in pursuing these fees. The campaign finance board has disputed approximately $160,000 of our claim, suggesting at a minimum a reduced payment of $591,000. Meanwhile, Ramsey County has requested to be excluded from any financial liability in this matter. So Judge Tostrud is taking our motion under advisement. We are hopeful for a ruling on this in the near future so we can get some real definition on the final number. Understanding that both the Campaign Finance Board and Ramsey County may lack sufficient funds to cover these costs, we support this contingent appropriation to ensure any court-awarded fees are paid promptly, preventing interest, accrual, and additional taxpayer burden. This law was not a creation of the county or the board. We would like to ensure that they are held harmless in this. So we are proud to have defended our members' constitutional rights, and we look forward to bringing this matter to a close. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Are there any committee questions? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask, Mr. Chair, what you intend to do with this bill?
The intent is to lay this bill over.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think actually laying it over is the right move because it is premature. My understanding is the court is still considering and there are motions about fees. So I will just, I will not ask any more questions since we're laying it over, but I will just make a statement for folks who weren't here and may not know much about this bill. You can get all of the conversations, can sometimes get confusing, but what this bill is about is the ability for foreign folks to use corporations, to do through corporations what they can't do directly. In the United States, you cannot, a foreign national cannot give directly to a campaign. What this bill tried to do is say you couldn't use a corporation as a conduit to do that spending. And I think we've heard a lot, right next door in Wisconsin, we heard a lot about whether you can buy elections, and use giant accumulations of money that people accumulate in the private sector in order to influence our democracy. What this bill tried to do was, make sure that the First Amendment, rights of citizens, the First Amendment rights of humans, were in the process. One district court has said and has interpreted the law in the way that Representative Fiske says, we agree and understand we are bound by courts, at least in this district. I think that there's some other places where it's playing out. There's a district court ruling. And I hope as we talk about the First Amendment, it is to me a little ironic that the chamber, the business lobby, for the largest corporations in the United States is using a civil rights, statute in order to claim fees from the public. But given that, and given that that is the law and that that is what a district court said, which again, we understand we're bound by, I'd say that I think the conversation about how and when we pay for it is premature. The last thing I will say is I think right now the issue of First Amendments is very big and important. We're seeing the First Amendment rights and the First Amendment rights of lawyers, of law firms, be really questioned by what's happening at the federal level. I hope that as we think about the chamber and other folks, they're standing up for the rights of those lawyers. And then the last thing I will say is, you know, we know, and we've talked about this, that the influence of corporations, the largest corporations and big money in our politics, we know how our constituents feel about it. We have now had, this is the second time that we have had bills up from the chamber. One was to draw our maps. Now it's to give unlimited, foreign influence corporations to be able to spend unlimited dollars and for us to pay for their litigation in order to be able to do that. I don't think that that's what Minnesotans want our democracy to look like. So I was obviously disappointed in that court's decision. I think it's actually not in line with the jurisprudence of the last 50 years and with Citizens United. That said, a district court decision, which we are bound by in Minnesota, did decide that. And so I'm glad we are laying this bill over. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. For the people watching in the audience, that discussion was about the law that was passed previously. Not this bill. This bill is specifically saying there are local government entities that followed the law that was passed by the legislature. They lost in court, and they're incurring some cost. In the recent history, there was a law passed, and a constitutional office sued several counties, local governments, for following that law. They lost, and the legislature stood up and said, you were following the law, we'd want to hold you blameless, and we'll pay for the legal expenses. And that is sort of the corollary of this bill, is trying to address not burdening local government with the cost incurred by following what we pass into law. And if the author probably can give a better explanation so we're clear on that point. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And there is much we could relitigate about the discussion we had, much that I disagree with the characterization from Representative Greenman about what the bill did. Suffice it to say that if the description of the bill as being about actual foreign corporations, it wouldn't have been the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce that sued and prevailed in this litigation, which is what they did. If the district court's decision was in fact incorrect, as Representative Greenman suggests, then the state, represented by the Attorney General's office, could have appealed that to the Eighth Circuit and even to the U.S. Supreme Court. The state has chosen not to do that. And there were efforts last year when this bill was before us to try to fix the tailoring problems, to fix some of the issues that were involved if we actually wanted to do something about foreign influence in our laws. The bill was really an attempt to get around the Citizens United case and to target certain political actors, and I think that's the reason why the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce was able to, on behalf of its members, vindicate their constitutional rights in this case. And the bill is going to come due soon. The judgment on attorney's fees has not yet come into being, but the judgment on the merits has come into being. The state has conceded in their meet and confers with the plaintiffs that they are going to be obligated to attorney's fees, and they have conceded that that obligation is at least some significant number in excess of $500,000. And so it is really important that we as the state plan ahead for what's going to come in just a few months, a very significant legal obligation. And again, a legal obligation that's the consequence of an avoidable mistake by the legislative branch. This was foreseeable. It was, in fact, foreseen by many of the legislators. I know I was here. I was one of the people warning that this was foreseeable. That warning was not heeded by the legislative majorities that passed. Again, what was House File 3? It was a priority of the legislative majority at that time to pass this law that has now resulted in this several hundred thousand dollar monetary obligation to the state of Minnesota. As we're going into this tight budget negotiating period, I think it's very important that we account for that legal that monetary obligation that's coming as a result of that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Additional questions, comments? Seeing none, I move that House File 2792 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we don't have the author for the next one on the agenda, but we do have the author for 2083. So the chair moves House File 2083 before the committee. And the author can proceed with presenting your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. And there's an amendment to get the bill in its proper format that I would like to offer to.
And I would move the DE1 amendment before the committee for getting the bill in the form in which the author prefers. Please proceed with informing us on the DE and your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. This bill came from townships that I have 14 townships in my district, and there are several townships across the state of Minnesota. And this bill, what it does is I amended it to have the Senate language in it and also to clearly define the word township in it and also special districts, because in the situations that some of the townships have found themselves in, we have different special districts, and they would have language requiring an audit that several of the accountants have said this really isn't a necessary procedure to have. And so this bill allows us to modify this and to clean up the language to allow townships to do the audit every 5 years, and then they have jurisdiction to have it done more frequently also in the language. So that's what this bill is. The audits can cost up to $20,000-$25,000 for small townships annually, and so this is an expense that's I don't believe is necessary to make sure proper controls are in place, and that's this bill.
Are there any questions from members? That Right. This is on the before we vote on the DE. I like DEs to get a little bit more discussion than just a standard amendment. Representative Freiberg, did you have a? Okay. All in favor of adopting the DE, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment has been adopted, and the author, you can proceed, or you do have a testifier.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to turn over my time now for the testifiers. Thanks.
Welcome. And introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Quam and members of the committee. My name is Julie Blaha, and I'm your state auditor. Actually am here in support of this bill. And with me for technical support is is the OSA Government Information Division Director, Kathy, and she will be available for specifics. Now, the main reason for this bill is the shortage of public finance professionals. For those of you on another committee have seen the stat I throw around the most often, right now 75% of all CPAs could retire today. It is getting to be a crisis across the country. And so when you have a shortage of a resource, but the resource is important. So while we're dealing with a shortage, we still, Minnesotans are still demanding quality oversight. So what are our options? There are technological solutions. There are some recruitment and retention solutions, all kinds of things. This, though, is a part of one of the focus solutions. If we are able to focus the resources we have where the risk is greatest, we're going to be able to, I think, to weather the shortage. So what this is an adjustment of one of the thresholds that are on the low end for one specific group of our local government people. And where we're looking for places where we can take heat off the system without raising risk too high, we're looking for a special kind of place. And that's a place where we can drop entities from a particular engagement without changing the amount of finances overall that are under audit. So if you, I'll just direct your attention to the sheet. I didn't want to leave you without a table. I can get you a graph later if you want, but you take a look at that table. One of the things you'll see is we ran a number of scenarios for legislators who have been talking about thresholds this session. We worked them through our audit and reporting group, which is a group of public auditors, private auditors, most of the big private auditors that work on audits in Minnesota, local government officials, and we have Bjorn Olson has been particularly active on that group, Representative Olson, and Representative Patty Anderson, as well as Senator Heather Gustafson are also assisting us on this. And a special thanks to Representative Olson, who was willing to also to author this bill if needed. And so as you look at this sheet, what you'll see is with these different options, what I'm looking for is a big difference between the portion of entities and the change in the total revenue. So when we say total revenue, for instance, on the townships, this is all the money in townships in Minnesota. This is our 2023 numbers. Those are the last fully covered numbers we have. So this actually might be a little bit less. You might see fewer people falling under this. It's a conservative estimate. So if you go from the $272,000 thresholds right now up to $1 million, what you see is you may see a big drop in the number of entities. You might see, again, like 21 entities dropping out of townships, over 100 entities dropping out of cities. But if you take a look at the total revenue and the portion of that, you'll see that's a very small drop there. So we're only going down about 1%. Or even less than 1% in these cases of actual coverage. No choice we make right now will be risk-free. However, we believe this will help us focus so that where we're, it is a bit of a drop, a drop, it takes heat off the system without exploding the risk. We also had a thing to balance it out. You'll see part of the amendment includes an additional requirement on townships. We've had, as you'll see on this sheet, we've had some challenges with township reporting because they don't fall in the same structure as cities and counties. If a city or county doesn't report to us, We hold up their county program aid or we hold up their local government aid. We don't do anything with township aid. As a result, we have had some significant issues with underreporting. So this is a good backstop. We think that, yes, we're changing the threshold in a way that is going to take heat off the system, and we're trying to balance out decreasing the risk of doing that. And with that, we'll be available for any questions.
Any member questions? Seeing none, any closing remarks to the author?
Thank you, Chair. And members, thank you for hearing this bill. This is a bill that came from the people that live in the townships that had a very, I think, a great common sense bill that will help. $20,000 in a township is a lot of money annually, and so they would prefer that it's being used for the roads and for the people they serve. So thank you very much, and I think this has got the safeguards it needs.
Thank you. And with that, I will lay House File 2083 as amended over for possible inclusion. Next would be House File 1665. And I see the author and the testifier that signed up. And then the author can begin presenting your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1665 is an opportunity for rural water districts who want to get the right of way to install, the right to install water lines and other infrastructure to be able to do so in the right of way. Minnesota Statute 222.37, which is attached in my notes, allows certain utilities to install infrastructure within a public road right of way. For years, both Red Rock and the other water systems in my district have relied on this statute to install water lines within a public road right-of-way. The problem that we have here is that the statute is somewhat vague if rural water districts have the right to install water lines within public road right-of-ways. And with me today is Dominic Jones to give you further details from his expertise.
Thank you, Representative.
Please introduce yourself and give your affiliation.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dominic Jones. I'm manager of Red Rock Rural Water System down in southwest Minnesota. Happy to be here, and I'd like to explain a little bit if I can proceed, Mr. Chair. Members, the Red Rock Rural Water System is not alone in this. There are five rural water systems currently in the state of Minnesota. There are three of them in southwest Minnesota, being Red Rock Rural Water System, Rock County Rural Water System, Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water. And in the northwest, we have two additional water systems up there, and there could be more in the future. Our intent at a rural water system is to get good quality water to folks who have terrible water, and southwest Minnesota is known for that. And so as we're proceeding with building new infrastructure, and we have a large project coming up this year that'll include 200 miles of pipeline to be installed, one of the things that we have to deal with is the public right-of-way. Just as other utilities like electric, fiber, natural gas, those type of things that are commonly found in all of our statewide road ditches. Now, historically, we started as a small system with just 400 miles of pipeline. Today, we have about 2,500 miles of pipeline. Of that, there's about 40% that is in public right-of-way. So we attempt to get easements parallel and adjacent to the road right-of-ways, a 30-foot easement, where other utilities may not do that. Power lines, producers do not want power lines in the middle of their fields. And rural water is installed 6 foot at a 6 foot depth, generally, in southern Minnesota. Up north, it's maybe up to 9 foot. But if we cannot get a private easement, of which we pay crop damages for, if we cannot attain that, we need to assure ourselves that we can be in the public right-of-way. I think we do have that to some extent, but it's not clear. And this bill, as Representative Schumacher stated, is to clarify that. I think that, you know, we already work closely with the entities, the State Department, Highway Department, local counties. We're in parts of nine counties. And by the way, some of the permitting is all different. I wish it was all standard. But we do go through that process with each individual county, townships, and we work closely with them to assure that we do nothing improper within the county right-of-ways or state right-of-ways or townships. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from members? Seeing none, closing statement from the author.
Oh, I thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just appreciate the opportunity to have this issue in front of the committee and for your consideration.
And with that, I will lay House File 1665 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Next will be House File 1917, and I will move House File 1917 before the committee. And if the author and I see a testifier would get ready. And Representative Anderson, go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, House File 1917, deals with the area of public data, what's private, what's not private. And it kind of traces back to the 1990s as I did some research. And then it was revised in the year 2012 and added a group of people to the bill. But some dates and numbers were put in that exempted, as you can see in the bill, cities higher or lower than 7,500 people and the counties with a population of fewer than 5,000. Not quite sure where those numbers came from, but this bill, Mr. Chair and members, deletes those numbers and makes all cities and counties, no matter of their size, subject to this bill. And it was heard in the State Gov Committee and received, well, in my opinion. There was one concern raised by the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. We have an amendment, Mr. Chair, I believe the A1 that I'd like to introduce.
I will put forth the A1 amendment. The author would explain the amendment.
Well, the amendment, Mr. Chair, is on page 3, line 10. It just deletes four words, and I'll let the testifier speak to it, but it just kind of gives some comfort language to people who may be in small towns where you have a couple, two or three people that kind of are the entirety of city government, and there was concern about the ambiguity of that provision or those words. So I'll let my testifier speak to that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. O'Rourke.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Cap O'Rourke with the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. A little bit of history, as Representative Anderson said, this law was put into place to exempt small cities and small counties. Something that took place in, I believe, the early 2000s is there was a police chief in a city of approximately the population of 7,000. They had done an investigation. The police chief resigned. The details of that investigation could not be made public. It only became public after the post board ended up not renewing their license. And so they looked back and saw this, and they wanted to get clarity on this. We support that effort. One of our concerns is, as I've said in many committees, is small cities with less than 5,000 have limited staff. And some of our cities, in almost all of our cities, many people wear many different hats. And there's a line in this bill that says the equivalence of. Well, if you take a city of 1,000 and they have 3 staff, I guarantee you almost every one of those staff is doing the equivalency of the head of parks or the head of transportation, or the head of utilities. And they are having many different roles. Initially, this law was only made to, and it does incorporate the chief clerk, chief administrative officer, and so they are subject to this. Our concern is that any investigation would basically capture all the city employees. That is not the case for larger cities. This is not all city employees are, would their data be made publicly available? It's only the heads or directors of certain departments. And in small cities, almost every one of our employees essentially is acting as the head or director of some various department. That's why the population cap was initially put in, or what we argued along with the league. And so our concerns are, by removing the population cap and still having that language of equivalent to, you're unintentionally catching up all of the city employees at our small cities.
Thank you. We have not voted on the amendment yet. Any questions in regards to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment passes. I believe there's a member of the audience. Introduce yourself and testify briefly.
Mr. Chairman and members of the public, my name is Rich Neumeister. I am supportive of the bill. I've been involved in the development of that bill and that section, as I said to you last week when I testified. What the bill does, it enhances transparency and accountability, promotes fairness and consistency. It also does public trust, and it also is a deterrent to misconduct. But I would like to speak to the amendment that was done. I think when you take equivalent out, it has more impact other than just small communities. What has happened is, in cities, you can be considered a head, but you might be called a coordinator, not a manager. You might be called something else than a director. And so as the law has progressed since 2012, this is when it was with cities, there were coordinators who were investigated, who had authority over millions of dollars and a lot of stuff. And then they quit. If you look at the language, if you look on page 2, lines 225 through 230, that is the operational language where the data becomes public. So if you're a public official, you're investigated, that becomes public after the investigation. If you quit or resign while the investigation is happening, like Mr. Chairman is with Representative Acum's bill trying to deal with the police chief of the Met Council, that becomes public. So when you do it to this and put in equivalent, it sort of brings some ambiguity and even more to where you're trying to bring small cities under. You're getting rid of the caps, but how small, let's say in a small city, you are doing a director of public works kind of responsibility out of three. Maybe you might also be the director of Parks and Rec, as at least what the testifier said. If you are being investigated for something you did as the director of public works, spending extra money somewhere or doing that or whatever it might be, and then you decide to resign your position of that, I think the public deserves a right to know, for that specific investigation, for the specific duty you were doing, and if you were doing something, maybe not named Director of Public Works, but you were still doing the public works direction for that city of 1,000, that should be public. When you take the word equivalent out, I think we then go to less transparency, less sunshine, what the bill's trying to do. But anyways, I wanted to at least speak to that point. I just want consistency all over. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's my 2 cents. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Any comments? This is going to be laid over. Representative Freiberg.
I think it's generally consistent with the legislation that Chair Acum had related to the Met Council. So maybe the language could still be workshopped or related to the equivalent positions, but I think it's generally a well-intentioned bill.
Thank you, Representative. Any final comment from the author?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. At least in my hometown of 1,204 people, they have a director of public works, a director of parks, so I really don't see that that emission or omission of those words is a huge piece as it relates to small towns. But anyway, thank you for hearing the bill. I would appreciate your support, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, House File 1917, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. That would be the next bill, will be 2709. The author can proceed to the table. And I will move that House File 2709 be before the committee. The author can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Quam, and Co-Chair Freiberg, and all members of the committee. I am grateful for the opportunity to present House File 2709 to you. This bill is about equal access to democracy, so that residents have access to political candidates and to be counted as part of the census. As elected members, we are committed to upholding our democracy. The elements in this bill are critical elements to fair and equal participation in it. Every Minnesotan, regardless of whether they live in a single-family home or a multifamily building, should have that same access. This bill addresses two key barriers. It standardizes and defines the reasonableness of access hours to be a minimum of from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. A building may allow for access outside of these hours, but this is the established minimum standard. Number two, it ensures that resident access to candidates and to be counted by the census in the event that there is no return communication from a property owner when either a candidate or a census enumerator is trying to access the building. Right now, if a property owner does not return that communication, a tenant may not get that access to the enumerator or candidate. There's a third piece in here that just encourages but does not require that property owners share about the upcoming visit with residents. So why am I bringing this bill? Well, residents rent their homes in districts all across our state, and it's important that they are counted and that they receive the same level of access to political candidates so they can make informed decisions in elections, just as their neighbors and single-family homes do. I'm happy to work through any stakeholders with any stakeholders to address any issues in this bill to accomplish this fair access goal. So thanks again for your consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from members? Seeing none, I will lay over House File 2709 for possible inclusion. And then the next two bills are authored by Chair Freiberg, and we have been running at under 10 minutes a bill.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair.
Well, if the chair would like to move his bill.
Yes. I will move House File 2098 be referred to the General Register, I think was the motion. Hold on, I just forgot the copy of the bill from my packet.
Thank you. And I would think that the chair would want to move the DE1
yes.
To get it in the form that you want to start out with.
Yes, I will move the DE1 amendment.
Proceed with your presentation of your amendment.
Sure. So this bill reflects some work that Chair Quam and I did over the last week or so. Just finding areas of agreement in the local government realm that we could move out as part as a local government policy bill. So the bills included in the DE amendment include Representative Gordon's publication of temporary polling places, locations required, Representative Altendorf, Vice Chair Altendorf's standard for determining the residence of an individual subject to a civil commitment order, Vice Chair Lee's polling place closure and change notice bill, Representative Tab.
One moment. I believe we're doing
the local government. I'm sorry. You're right. That was the election policy. Yeah. Thank you for catching that. I have them in the wrong order in my thing. So, yes. So, this, as I said, this was the local government bill. So, not the election policy, but we'll discuss those provisions shortly, in about 10 minutes, I expect, based on the pace we've been going. So this bill, rather, this amendment, the DE amendment before you, as I said, it does reflect the decisions made by Chair Quam and I. So this includes Representative Akam's broadening public data for Met Council personnel bill, similar to the one we just heard from Chair Anderson. Representative Bjorn Olson's bill dealing with increasing reimbursable amounts for eminent domain appraisals. Representative Harder's bill modifying public notice publishing requirements when a newspaper is discontinued. Representative Zalesnikar's bill making changes to the governing chapter for St. Louis County. Representative Rarick's bill dealing with statutory cities, public utility commission size. Representative Mamani Hiltzley's bill requiring that the landlord-tenant guide be produced for tenants, and Representative Chair Paul Anderson's bill dealing with the Swift County Hospital Board. And it looks like there is a there's a chart in your packet listing the bills there, and happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any questions on the DE?
There's somebody sitting next to me. It looks like they want to testify.
Please introduce yourself and give your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologies for butting in here. My name is Graham Berg-Moberg. I'm with the Township Association. I just want to comment on Section 3 here. That would be the Representative Harder bill. Township Association is very enthusiastic about this. We would just respectfully ask the committee to consider situations in which a political subdivision does not have reliable access to the Internet or a website. So we'd ask for some language more clearly providing for that case.
Thank you. Does the author have a comment?
Sure. I mean, I'm certainly open to considering some language tweaks. I'd want to check in with Representative Harder on this one. I know she worked very hard to get buy-in from the stakeholders on the language that was there.
And I agree with the author. Harder worked hard.
It's right there in the name.
So, not seeing any questions, all in favor of adopting the DE1, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. DE1's adopted. We've got an additional six amendments. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my amendment is the A2 amendment. This is the Rarick bill that we'd heard a few weeks ago, and there was some discussion in committee, and she did go back, and I believe that this does have the Democrat support now with the new language.
Any?
Yeah, I have no objection to the language, okay. Mr. Chair.
So Representative Altendorf moved the A2?
Yeah, so I would like to move the A2 amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions from seeing none, all in favor of the A2, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Nay, if you're opposed. Seeing none, the A2 is adopted. And Representative Altendorf had a second amendment.
Yes. The other one is the A5. So, again, we're just including into Chair Freiberg's bill here some of these bills that were just heard today. So this A5 amendment, I move that we are including the Schumacher bill that we just heard today.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, All in favor of adopting the A5, say aye.
Aye.
Oppose, nay. The A5 is adopted. Representative Davis, you had a couple of amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got the A4 amendment, which is just including the Zalesnikar House File 2083 as amended. That is the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any comment from the author?
No, it seems like a good bill. Happy to accept it.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor adopting the A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Oh, I stand corrected. It was the A4 amendment. Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A4 is adopted. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another very difficult amendment here. The A6, it adds the House File 1917 that we heard from Representative Anderson into the bill. That is my motion.
Any discussion?
I encourage members to support the amendment.
Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A6 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A6 is adopted. Representative Coulter has an amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For reference, this is the A1 amendment, and I'm going to start off just by clarifying that my intention is to offer and withdraw this amendment. I just wanted to get language, frankly, in front of the committee for a conversation that I hope we will have in the future regarding minimum parking mandates or mandatory parking minimums, depending on how you like to refer to them. I've been working on this language, and I think I've come to a better place with it, but I know the conversation isn't quite ripe yet. I just wanted to sort of air this publicly that mandatory parking minimums are blunt instruments that often rely on faulty data and lazy policymaking, and to be frank, result often in government overreach where it is not really appropriate. And I wouldn't necessarily be opposed to those things if the outcomes were limited to cities that implement them. But the fact is that they result in bad outcomes across the state. The cost of building parking and the average parking spot, last I saw for surface parking, can run somewhere in the $10,000 to $13,000 range. And for structured parking, for ramps, it can be twice or three times as much. That cost is holding back needed economic development and housing. And we know that more pavement equals less green space. I would also argue that mandatory parking minimums are just simply not necessary. Cities already have significant policy leeway on land use decisions, and there are ways to address intensity and density of use outside of them as well. Like I said, this language I think represents a compromise that does address key concerns, but I also recognize that more conversation is needed, so I will withdraw the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. I do not see any other amendments before us. Would the author have a closing statement? Or
sure. I think the bills in here represent good policy. You know, each of them, I think we spent a good 10 minutes discussing. I don't probably need to go in any more detail, but I appreciate the good work from both sides of the aisle on this issue, on this bill, and look forward to continuing to carry it forward.
Well, thank you. And to the people watching on TV, yes, we can actually get along and do the work for the citizens. With that, Chair Freiberg renews his motion that House File 2098, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Registry. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. And it does pass. Chair Freiberg can go to his next bill, which I believe is the last bill on our agenda.
So, Mr. Chair, I will move House File 1378 be referred to the General Register.
Okay, the author has moved. Did you want to move the DE5 to get it in the form of which?
Yes, I will move the DE5 amendment. Now I can provide the description I've been waiting for so long to give. So this includes provisions that Chair Quam and I worked together over the last week to include good provisions from both sides of the aisle. So specifically, it includes House File 993, Representative Gordon's bill dealing with publication of temporary polling locations, House File 1840, Vice Chair Altendorf's bill creating a standard for determining the residence of an individual subject to a civil commitment order, Vice Chair Lee's bill dealing with polling place closure and change notice until an occurrence of a presidential election or redistricting, Representative Tabke's bill dealing with absentee voting provisions. Chair Quam, it has your provision setting filing periods for special elections. The vehicle bill, House File 1378, contains a few provisions related to the timeline for filing statements of economic interest. And then both Chair Quam and myself, we had two bills. House File 1800 was yours, Chair Quam. House File 2073 was mine. They both contained multiple provisions related to the administration of elections. We took kind of the best provisions out of both bills, good provisions anyway, out of both bills, and I won't summarize them all here, but includes a lot of them. And I think there should be a summary in your packet. So that's the DE5 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from members? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the DE5, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The DE5 is adopted. I notice there are two testifiers that are signed up. One of them is on Zoom. And if you want to approach, we'll have Mr. Stahlberg testify first on Zoom.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ms. Michael Stahlberger. I'm Director of Property and Environmental Resources for Blue Earth County, home to about 40,000 registered voters. Thank you for the opportunity to testify remote today. I'm actually at an elections administrator training and meeting, so it's quite timely to talk about some elections policy. And in House File 1378, we see a lot of really good elections policy from an elections administrator perspective. I'm representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers. That's all 87 counties, auditors, treasurers, recorders, finance officers, and it also includes our elections administrators. Some of the good policy that we're seeing in this bill that we want to draw your attention to specifically is the removal of the permanent absentee ballot application request from the election day registration applications. This will help streamline some of our election day activities, and this was a measure that our association strongly supports. We are also very pleased to see the inclusion of the absentee ballot application deadlines. That is also a provision that the Minnesota Association of County Officers brought forward along with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and imposing a 7-day deadline for that application process in most cases, other than in-person drop-offs, will help with the excessive workload that occurs right before the elections, but more importantly, it will help us achieve better service to our voters by making sure that they understand their options to vote, to make sure that they can cast a ballot and have it be counted in the election. We're also very pleased to see the ballot corrections or the errors and omissions provisions that were provided in this bill. Creating a ballot that is accurate and prompt is one of our highest priorities, and having the ability to correct some technical changes automatically and to correct other changes in agreement with the parties involved without a court or judicial setting will help make that process more efficient. There are other provisions that we are pleased to see in the bill, but we do want to have some qualifications or some comments associated with them. And the first one would include the provision that allows for cities that have been delegated the absentee ballot process to restrict that to 18 days or the entire 46 days. While that provision in itself is a good, and we can support that from a local governance perspective. We do have some concerns with making sure that both parties understand expectations, especially the provision that allows a city to unilaterally opt out of absentee balloting without really having the discussion with the county administrator of the elections. We also are pleased to see the chain of custody plans and the provisions that are built around that to have some consistency statewide. However, we do have some concern about how quickly the first plan needs to be adopted by counties and or cities, and then how it would be reviewed subsequently within the next half a year. We'd like to see a potential extension on that first plan so it's more timely and tied to elections in 2026. Another provision, the last provision we'd like to just add some comment on that we still think is a good policy addition to this bill is the candidate filing period. Adjusting that late candidate filing period, so for most of our cities, our school boards, our townships, any of those offices that don't have a primary election, that period has been shifted back, which will allow more time for ballot design, and it also removes it out of conflict with the statewide primary election. All of those changes are supported. However, in my read of the bill, it looks like that change is only being applied to cities, and we would like to see that same change also apply to townships and school districts. The last two provisions I'll bring to your attention are provisions that our association has more significant concern with. While the policies in and of themselves make sense, we think there might need to be a little bit of modification to the language. For example, the college student housing list. That is now, under this bill's being proposed to be allowed for all 18 days of early voting. That is a good change. It will allow us to more efficiently and effectively serve those college students that are registering to vote at their college addresses. However, that list is only provided to us 20 days before the election to be used 18 days before the election under this proposal. In those 2 days is probably not enough time for us to review the list, get it associated with the correct precincts, and then actually have it in a usable fashion. So we'd like to extend the period and get that list provided to us sooner. The last provision that we'll bring some attention to, the Secretary of State's office, Ms. Friedman, may have more comment on, but it is the provision that requires additional data to be associated with absentee ballot applications in our statewide voter system. I'm talking about the fields as in the date that the ballot was signed, the ballot application was signed, the date that that application was processed in our system. That information can be provided. We do a lot of data entry with absentee ballot applications. However, I'm not sure if the statewide system can accommodate that yet or can accommodate it by the time expected. Again, maybe Ms. Freeman can address that. In summary, thank you very much, Chair Quam, Chair Freiberg, for your work on this bill. It does bring in a lot of provisions that the elections administrators across the state will support and will see as ways to improve the efficiency in our service to voters. There are technical changes, there are administrative items, and there are changes that are much needed and much appreciated. Again, thank you for your time. I'll remain on the Zoom call for any questions that may come from the committee. Thank you.
And thank you, and Ms. Freeman, if you would introduce yourself and give your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Quam and Chair Freiberg for this bill. My name is Nicole Freeman. I work for the Office of the Secretary of State. I'm here today to testify and provide feedback on House File 1378. I really appreciate the work of the committee as well as in working with us as well as local election administrators to bring this bill forward here today. I believe this bill continues to support the balance of access for voters with the needs for election security, as well as making improvements to help election administrators do their jobs, which they do very well. As Mr. Stahlberger mentioned, it does make a number of technical adjustments, and we're always happy to do that technical cleanup so statute's more uniform and up-to-date. A few of the key policies that we support in the bill are the removal of the permanent absentee application box from the voter registration application. It allows, and then the bill also allows permissively the office to add it to the absentee ballot application instead. I think that's our intent, and if there is an opportunity to change that may to a must, we prefer it was required on some form and can continue to discuss that. We also want to thank you for section number 12 which adds clarifying steps that ballot boards need to take when they're opening signature envelopes and ballot envelopes. The section makes it clear also that ballot envelopes need to be retained, and I think sets a really clear statewide process. Section 23 formalizes the chain of custody planning that county and municipal election administrators already carry out. It empowers our office to offer guidance and also promotes those discussions between local election officials and their county election officials as they update the plans ahead of each statewide election. Finally, we appreciate the inclusion of the Arizona Omissions out-of-court remedy. We think this will really improve the process for election officials, as well as cut down on, allow county attorneys to spend their time on other matters, and also judges in some of our particularly rural district courts where their time is strapped too. And additionally, it ensures voters can receive a correct ballot even sooner. We hope to continue conversations and hope that the committee would consider putting back in the subpoint that incentivized a candidate to come to an agreement or potentially face a penalty of paying court fees. As I know, I noted last week when the admin bill was heard, I think that was last week. My weeks are a little blurring together, but those fees could only be required to be paid in a limited situation where the losing party, the judge found that a losing party's argument was not reasonable, and additionally that it would not cause an undue financial burden to that individual. So we really feel like this incentive is important, and without it, that one candidate who's trying to use the error maybe unfairly to their advantage could cause unnecessary delay in getting those ballots reprinted and back out to voters. We have some, we share some of the feedback that MACO shared around effective dates and can continue in those conversations as well. And then have a couple of things that we'd also like to continue to work on. In section six, the office would prefer 5 days for absentee applications to be received by mail, email, or fax, that the cutoff for when they need to be in, that be 5 days instead of 7. Section 7, our office shares concerns with MACO around the allowance for a city to just opt out of administering absentee voting if they are designated to do so by a county. We worry that it could cause significant gaps in voter access for voters, and the change doesn't address the impact to those voters. So we'd like to continue those conversations with all the stakeholders and members of the committee. Two other sections I wanted to mention, section 31 and 32. Our office prefers the flexibility for locals to use unaffiliated staff members to assist voters, either inside an absentee location or curbside. Each jurisdiction chooses how they staff those pre-election activities, and requiring them to hire two additional party balanced judges could be a significant financial burden for a small county or a small city. And I'm happy to continue the conversation and take questions. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And just a clarification on that, receiving an application within, you know, the difference between 5 and 7, there are multiple occasions, different locations in the state, of where some people don't receive their mail for a week. Mm-hmm. And I believe the intent was to give sufficient time to where if there was a delay in the mail, that they would actually receive it before election day. So I think that's something we can have some conversations on to do it. I think every party's intent is great. We just got to see what comes out with that. Yep. And the other thing I was going to bring up is there are two amendments. One, I move the A6, which was recommended by the nonpartisan staff, and it removes obsolete language, and it's more of a technical amendment. And if the author had a comment.
Yes, that is a technical amendment, I believe, and I would support it.
Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the A6 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A6 is adopted. The next one is A8. It's not straight technical, but it is something that in the rush to do the DE, there was an inadvertent portion that was left out. And this is the part in regards of clarifying the off-reservation temporary polling. And if the author had any comments on that.
No, my understanding matches up with yours that this was inadvertently left out, so I appreciate your understanding on that and would encourage members to support this.
Any clarifying questions for members? Seeing none, all in favor of the A8 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. And the A8 is adopted. And so all of the, the technical type stuff and the DE are present. Any additional comments from the author?
I know we have a few more amendments, one of which is the A4 that was Representative Jones's bill that was offered previously. Is that, would the chair entertain a motion to me offering that one?
There was quite a bit of discussion, and we came to agreement on a large number of things. This and the other two are sort of added additional to and outside of what we agreed upon. I don't think that there would be supporting votes from half of the committee. I do know that both of us had talked about some things would be offered on the floor. And so, we can go ahead and go through the process, but I anticipate there being a tie.
Okay. Thank you. I was unclear on the status of this one in particular. And my understanding of our conversation was that we would offer that there would be some amendments from both sides in committee. So, but rather than have a negative vote on this one, I will not offer the A4. And we can continue discussions on that one.
Yeah.
I believe members of my committee may wish to offer the other two. So,
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And apologize, I wasn't part of the negotiations. Appreciate all the work you all did. The A4 is, or the A3, excuse me, is language that was actually adopted by the Senate and let me just explain what it does, because I think it is making crystal clear something that our law already says, which is you can't buy or bribe or induce voters in order to register or vote a certain way. And what this language does is adds a place which I think is closing, or just making clear, again, I'm not sure if it's closing a loophole, I don't think the loophole is there, but that you can't offer a chance to win something that you also couldn't just provide, right? You can't indirectly advance, pay, give, promise, lend food, money, liquor, clothing, entertainment, or anything else of monetary value. That's already in the law. What this says is you can't additionally provide a chance to win any of those things in order to induce someone to vote or refrain from voting, have somebody register to vote, or have them sign a petition that's related to the election in the time where people are already voting. Why the urgency of doing this now, and why did I think the Senate add that bill to their election is because of the election we saw yesterday in Wisconsin, and we saw in 2024 this particular innovation, if you'd call it, of offering a lottery where you can give away $1 million in order to sign a petition that you end up getting at a very specific political rally. That happened in 2024 in Pennsylvania. We saw it yet last week and up to the election yesterday in Wisconsin. The reason I think it's important that we put this in Minnesota law is in Wisconsin, also what I heard from many voting rights lawyers and public officials is that Wisconsin, like Minnesota, prohibits offering anything of value to induce someone to vote. So again, already the law, but clearly there is some uncertainty because this practice, which moved from Wisconsin, from Pennsylvania to Wisconsin, is clearly moving west. The last thing I'll say is, as we have been talking about the issue of money in politics, and again, I think some conversations we've had on both sides of the aisle, you know, when Elon Musk or any other billionaire can give away $1 million as a lottery, we can't do that. But for him, it's, you know, I think it's 0.0003% of his net worth. So it's like $3 to you and I. And what this does and why this is such a problematic practice for our voters, it is people using their immense amount of wealth, in this case, the richest man in the world, but it doesn't have to be that way. There's lots of billionaires, in order to induce or cause folks to vote, to participate. We don't think that you should be able to buy, bribe, or induce somebody to participate. So this bill and this language just makes it very clear. And as I said, it's already in, the Senate added it. I wanted the opportunity for us in this committee to make a stand and really say what I think voters said last night, which is can't buy my vote. But this amendment makes clear that doesn't matter who you are, you can't buy or bribe or induce somebody with a lottery or with a direct payment when we're talking about Minnesota voters. So that's the amendment, and that's the purpose for it and the urgency with which I brought it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call vote.
Well, thank you. I guess, Representative Greenman, I understand the debate. I am surprised that there wasn't a great deal of discussion of a long history of Soros-funded activities that were meant and aimed at changing elections. And so I think this topic would need a strong discussion. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Representative Greenman, just a couple of questions. You're targeting or pointing out that Elon Musk had put money into the Wisconsin election that we just saw. And so my question to Representative Greenman is, how does she feel about billionaire Soros' son, I can't think of his name right now, shown clearly in pictures with Amy Klobuchar, with Governor Walz?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Altendorf. And if you've heard me in any other committees where I talk a lot about this, I think that there's too much money in our politics. And I think millionaires and billionaires have too much influence on all sides of the aisle. So I have no problem saying that, unfortunately, and like we heard at the beginning of this hearing, Citizens United and a whole set of other legal decisions have made it virtually impossible to stop outside political spending. I would support overturning Citizens United. I have a bill if folks want to talk about it. There's actually bipartisan interest in it. That's not what this is about. I support that. What this is about is saying it doesn't matter what billionaire supports who. What you can't do is use your resources to induce, bribe, buy, or offer as a chance. Now, we've only seen this happen once, but like I know, innovation spreads. So yeah, both sides of the aisle could use this. We could see billionaires all over use this. This is value agnostic, except for it is standing up for Minnesota voters who should be able to participate without having their vote bought, induced, bribed, or anything else. And so for me, if you want to work on getting big money and billionaires out of politics, lots of bills on that, and I'd love to continue working with you. This is one of those bills.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Greenman, in the Wisconsin election that we just saw, over 70% of the donations were coming out of the state of Wisconsin to the lady that was running for the judicial position. And it was something like 10 to 20% of the donations was coming from out of state to the Republican. Okay, that is a fact. In 2022, over $36 million, $36 million came into Minnesota from D.C. PACs and lobbyist groups. We don't need to think very hard to know what happened in 2022 with our elections and that there was a trifecta that happened here in Minnesota, that the governor, the Senate, the House all went to Democrat, and that $36 million was overwhelmingly for the Democrats' elections. That's a fact. Now, it's interesting, as I have sat on this elections committee now for 3 years, that we skirt this and we put things into context that we're against dark money. And yet it is we are very capable of showing that the money coming into Minnesota and to Wisconsin elections, 70 to 80% of it is coming from outside of state and is funding the Democrats. That is a fact.
People watching, this is the time to get your popcorn out. And to the author, I don't think we're going to hit the 10-minute mark on this.
I tried.
But I believe Representative Greenman may have a comment.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. On the 10-minute mark, both of our co-chairs. I hear what you're trying to do here, but this bill is about ensuring that it doesn't matter who the billionaires are, that they can't use their billions of dollars to buy, induce, or bribe voters. So if we agree that billionaires, millionaires, anyone who has enough money to do this shouldn't be doing that, then this is an easy yes vote. I understand you want to litigate the last couple of elections. We can have that conversation. That's not what this bill does. This isn't even a money and politics bill. This just says that you can't provide a chance to win in order to induce somebody to vote or refrain from voting in a particular way, to register to vote, or to register or be eligible to sign a petition that's materially related to the election. That's what the language of this bill does. So if you want to keep outside money, if you want to keep billionaires, whether it's inside or outside the state, from influencing directly voters, then you should vote for this bill or this amendment.
Thank you, Representative. And to both members and the audience, there were provisions to monitor donations, small donations from outside the state or the area of the election. There are a lot of details that we went through in committee that didn't make it into the agreement. So I believe Representative McDonald wants to join the energetic discussion. Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, I'll keep it under 10 minutes. My thoughts, Representative Greenman, is if the intention is grand, certainly to keep dark money out of politics, but in the discussion, it is, I would say, inauthentic to bring up one side and not the other, such as Mr. Soros's contributions to parties, and of course, Elon Musk's supposedly, of course, his contribution to the world is unfathomable to anything Mr. Soros would ever do. That's my own two cents. But if you want to be sincere in this, if this was my bill, I wouldn't just side one side and make an accusation of one man. If it truly is your intention and you're sincere, which I think you are, knowing you for a number of years, then to give you credence, it would probably benefit you to include both sides of the aisle of who's contributing to the campaigns, not just one side, because then that divides us. Now, this discussion could have ended had you included the very name that Representative Eldendorf brought up in contributing to the dark money politics. So that's my advice, sage advice after 14 years being here.
And to the audience, this is a preview of the floor session when this bill comes forward. Representative Davis.
Sorry, I thought you were going to speak. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I guess I will speak to this and the unintended consequences this could be at. And good point to Representative McDonald. Yeah, it already spoiled me the way you presented it, to be honest with you. Completely spoiled me. But unintended consequences of what your amendment could do. I mean, I'm just trying to think outside the box here because we have to do that as legislators. I mean, what Musk is doing is having to do with petitions. I believe in Pennsylvania, support for the First and Second Amendment, which a judge found throughout the lawsuit, I believe. And then here in Wisconsin, a petition speaking out against activist judges, which we have a very big problem with activist judges in this country right now. So I completely support his petitions, which I know your amendment is trying to address. But also I could just see a political rally where perhaps political flags or hats or shirts are being given out, and would someone be in trouble for something like that, and they had a petition there. So I just think there could be unintended consequences with your amendment, and I will definitely not be supporting it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I notice you don't have one arm behind your back, but you're holding your own with multiple people in the discussion, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to just focus us in on the language. The problem, Representative McDonald, I'm trying to stop a practice that we have actually only seen one person do. The conversation about money and politics that we're having, the dark money and politics, all of those pieces, this is a voting bill, not a money and politics bill. I have those two. And in those cases, as I said, I think that there's too much money in our politics. Billionaires, we could name all of them, and there's probably many we don't even know their names of. But the reason that I had to say Elon Musk is that he's the only person who's done this. He did it in Pennsylvania, he did it in Wisconsin. And what I'm trying to say is I believe, and I think that there's good interpretation that both in Wisconsin and here, that it is against the law. So I could have not said his name, but there's only happened once or twice now. So we're getting in front of that practice or innovation. But certainly I would not want to see George Soros or Bezos or name your billionaire do this either. And so I'm happy to list all of those names. I don't want any of them to do this, which is to use their resources to induce people to register to vote. Now, I hear you on the petition. That's why this is very narrowly tailored. It's not about signing a petition. You can do that. It is about using promises to pay, to give money, to give food, to give a chance to win in order to get someone to put their name on a petition that is related to an election during the period where people are voting. And this is obviously a loophole closer, but you can have a petition. That's a First Amendment protected right. What you can't do is use those resources you have in order to induce people to register or to politically participate. To me, this is not actually a hard bill. It's already, I think, most baked into our law, but I want to make it really clear so that if this happens, we don't spend another, hundreds of millions, hundreds of thousands of dollars litigating it, and we can just say today, we don't think that the practice of buying, bribing, inducing people to participate is a good one. People should be able to do that on their own free will, and we want to keep that out of here. So that's what this bill is. Again, I would love to have bigger, more money in politics bills. I'd love to get rid of dark money in politics. This is just about bribing, advancing money, and treating people in the act of voting or registering or signing an election petition in the absentee period.
Thank you, Representative. And if I to believe the Strib, a billionaire targeted me a few elections ago, Bloomberg. So I think there's probably a few that get involved. Representative Roach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And yeah, Graveman, I Representative Graveman, I wouldn't support that amendment as well, or your bill. But my question for you is obviously we have some dark money in politics, but where's your position on having presidential candidates pay for endorsements from celebrities like Beyonce or Oprah?
Representative Greenman, I do think we've opened multiple rabbit holes, but Representative Greenman.
Representative Roach, we've only worked together a little bit, and you know that I could, as everybody's been on this committee for me a long time as a voting rights lawyer, I could probably talk about all this stuff, and I don't want to keep you under the 20-minute zone. I am not aware of that. I'd love to talk to you about it. I generally don't like the idea of using money in politics to sway voters, sway endorsements, sway anything. It's not a practice I am familiar with. It's not dealt with in this bill, but I'm happy to talk to you about it.
Well, I think that's a different bill, preventing candidates from using money to influence voters. But it gets down into the details, and anyone else interested in joining the seeing none? Representative.
I don't know the answer to this question. I try to make a habit of not asking questions I don't know the answer to, but how much money do we give to nonprofits of our tax dollars to encourage voters to register to vote and that kind of thing? So I'm guessing it's a considerable amount. I could be wrong on that, but so there's an awful lot of money that goes in to politics, and whether it makes a big difference one way or another, I guess I don't know. So,
well, Representative Gord, I believe we can try and get an idea from the Secretary of State, but it would not be in the next half hour, so we'll have to get that offline. But thank you for the question. Please take the roll.
Co-Chair Quam.
No.
Co-Chair Freiberg.
Yes.
Vice Chair Altendorf.
No.
Vice Chair Lee.
Yes.
Representative Acomb.
Yes.
Representative Coulter.
Aye.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Gordon.
No.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative McDonald. Representative Roach.
No.
Representative Vernig.
Yes.
It is baseball season. We won't be going in extra innings. A tie causes the motion to fail, and it's 6-6 tie. Is there a Representative Coulter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to offer the A5 amendment, and this language may look familiar to folks. This is the language of House File 2284, my bill, as we amended it in committee, relating to our laws around lobbying and what is and is not, who is and is not, excuse me, a lobbyist. Just very briefly, it does basically four things. It adds a definition for expert witness and clarifies that they are not, the situations under which they are not lobbyists, clarifies local staff-to-staff communication and how that is not lobbying. Spells out which local government authorities might cause someone to register as a lobbyist if they are lobbying them. And then it requires the Campaign Finance Board to produce a plain language handbook around lobbying requirements. I will be brief since we don't have the option of going 20 minutes on this one. I'm bringing this forward, frankly, because the train is leaving the station. Policy deadline, obviously, is Friday. on a state government bill. My understanding is that there is no mention of Chapter 10A in that bill, so it would not be germane to that bill on the floor. But more importantly, this is language that we asked the Campaign Finance Board to produce. In fact, we didn't ask them. We told them to produce this. And they did, and I think they did a really good job of it. And that is a group of a bipartisan group of experts on exactly this section of law. But more importantly, even than that, this is language that our local partners, our cities, our counties, our townships are asking for. They really desperately want clarification so that their staff can continue to do the good work that we all know that our local partners do. And that is the language that is in this bill. This is a few minor tweaks, but this is the recommendations from the Campaign Finance Board as they heard them directly from our local partners. And so, Mr. Chair, I think it is important for us to go on record so that our local partners know who is serious about taking on something that I know they care about. So I would request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Gee, I had 47 amendments I would have brought forward if we were going to go this route where we didn't have agreement on the details and the exact language. I anticipate there being another close vote. The author?
I'm just a bystander, Mr. Chair.
Who is that puppet master behind the curtain? It's the wizard. That's an obscure reference to a movie that I saw when I was a kid. Any further discussion? Let's take the roll then.
Co-Chair Quam.
No.
Co-Chair Freiberg.
Yes.
Vice Chair Altendorf.
No.
Vice Chair Lee.
Yes.
Representative Acomb.
Yes.
Representative Coulter.
Aye.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Gordon.
No.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative McDonald.
No.
Representative Roach.
No.
Representative Vernig.
Yes.
And the drum roll. And it is again a tie. And the motion fails. And, you know, forgive my bad dad humor, just trying to keep it a little bit lighter than the knockdown dragout that tune in for the floor session. Any closing comments from the author?
I appreciate your efforts to bring some levity to these proceedings, Mr. Chair. The provisions in here are good provisions that have bipartisan support, and I would encourage members to support the bill.
Well, all in favor of the bill, as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. And the bill passes. And so the House File 1378, as amended, passes on to the General Registry. I want to thank all the participants in this, I think, fairly nice, reasonable discussion, and timely as well. And with that, we are adjourned.